I'm Simi Abdullah, and I'd like to welcome you to Trillium Montessori Talks, the podcast where we dig into the theory and application of Montessori methodology in the classroom and beyond. This podcast is produced in cooperation with Letty Rising and other Trillium course creators. Our goal is to provide you with a weekly dose of tips, tools, and inspiration so you can optimize the classroom experience for your students and yourself. Ready? Let's talk Montessori.
Welcome to Montessori Talks, where we talk about all things related to the Montessori elementary environment and also other things related to Montessori. And today I have Rochelle Komoko, who is with the Wildflower Schools, and she is the executive director for stakeholder engagement. Did I get that correct, Rochelle?
You did. Okay. That's it.
Yeah. Yay. Okay. In Washington, D.C., and it is a public charter school that is also a Wildflower School. Rochelle has also worked at other public Montessori schools. She has been at private Montessori schools. I met her when she was a teacher and I was in my training in one of the classrooms like way long ago. So it has been kind of fun to watch your progression into all these different Montessori realms. And here you are in like this very new and innovative situation. Yeah. So I just had a few questions that I wanted to ask you today. And I guess starting out is just telling me about your role at Wildflower or, you know, what your school is about even.
Wonderful. So we are DC Wildflower Public Charter School, and we were chartered in April of 2021. And I came on board in August of 21 as the executive director. And really my job to start off was to build the infrastructure. Because if you can imagine, brand new charter school, while we had the charter, we didn't have the capacity to take any money. We didn't have the capacity to even hire people, though we did know who our first set of teacher leaders would be. So I really spent the first 6 to 9 months of my job building the infrastructure of the charter with support from a number of people, our Office of the State Superintendent for Education, OSSEE, and our authorizer, the DC Charter School Board, all really did a great job of supporting me. We were the only new charter. So we were the only school to get a new charter in 2021. No one will get a new charter probably until 2023 at best. So we had a lot of attention, for better or worse, because we were the only ones starting. What is interesting about Wildflower is, if you know it from, you know, national work, it's really meant to be community embedded, sometimes even street front. And what I love about it is that the teachers who are the ones who are running the schools are the ones who design it. They're the ones who decide what the emphasis will be. I mean, all about doing good Montessori, clearly, just as a baseline. But in addition to that, what else are they going to do? Our charter itself is really focused on getting Montessori in front of and in communities that haven't really traditionally thought about Montessori, right? We have been, it's a well-kept secret. People don't realize that it can, you know, be a wonderful environment for their children based on their misconceptions or based on just not even having any idea, you know, what it's about. And so Ebony Marshman and Zanzo DeLilly are the two teacher leaders who have started the River Seeds School, which is our first campus. And my role since August has been to work hand in hand with them to support them as they develop their school. They've done all the recruitment. They've, you know, designed their logo, come up with their school name, built a website, everything that you can imagine that school leaders would be doing, as well as thinking about how they were going to engage with families as teachers, right? How as teachers are we going to build relationships with families? How and where are we going to look for these students? And they settled on Ward 7. And if you know anything about Washington, D.C., you know that Ward 7 is one of the kind of historically disenfranchised communities. Our neighborhood in particular is one called Deanwood. We're just outside of Deanwood. And there just hasn't been a lot of development there. There are some really strong schools. There are lots of charter schools, but no Montessori in Deanwood, and certainly not Montessori at this scale. So our scale is just one or two classrooms. So we have a primary classroom, we'll have an elementary classroom, and that's going to be it. That campus will never get bigger, that facility. But I get the fun of doing this process every year with another pair or maybe two of teacher leaders who are ready to start designing this school or making real this school that they've been dreaming of wherever in the city they decide to settle. Right now, we're thinking about being in the two wards that are, we call it east of the river here in DC, Ward 7 and Ward 8, as well as two communities that have also been kind of rapidly gentrifying, but historically also under-resourced. So Ward 4 and Ward 5 have had a lot of Latinx community, have had a lot of kind of lower income folk. And so those are some other areas that we're really interested in getting to. So I have two more pairs of folks who are thinking about Ward 5, for example. And so, my job is to support them in doing this great work and to make sure that our authorizer is happy and that we're meeting kind of all of the necessary things to keep the charter and to keep that funding coming to them. But it is really about making this idea of really personalized micro schools happen for the public sector or in the public sector and be more accessible to people who can't or pay for private school.
And really at a neighborhood level, it sounds.
And really at a neighborhood level. Yeah, it's really wonderful. So we are tiny. Anyone who knows Montessori knows we started with 18 students, right? Pre-K threes and pre-K fours. And more than half of them are from within a mile or two of the school. So it's really just the best. They are very local. And the two teacher leaders have done a great job of building relationships with community organizations that are nearby. So we have a plot at a community garden. We are part of a CSA with an organization called Dreaming Out Loud that focuses on Black farmers. It's a Black farmer CSA. We're partnered with an after care provider that is also a Black owned business, and has been really excited to work with us. So as much as we can, we're investing in the community where we are and trying to use contractors and to use to build relationships that will build that community as well.
I love that. I mean, there's so many things that are neat about that. And I guess I just wanted to also make sure I understand everything. So it sounds like that the model of your DC Wildflower Schools is that there's generally going to be like teacher pairs or partners that work with each other. There'll be like a primary, which is 3 to 6, and then elementary.
Not necessarily. Just be two people doing primary. So that's the other thing. I mean, if you can, again, people who have been school leaders or even charter leaders, one of the challenges and I think exciting things about this job is that I don't necessarily know what we're getting next, right? I don't know for sure. It looks likely right now that the two next sets will be primary classrooms, which means to me, we better get some elementary classrooms too, because then, we really want to make sure that those children who are coming out of primary have someplace to go and stay in Montessori. Ebony and Zani built what I think is just a sweet partnership where they can grow their own, basically, their own elementary class. And those children will have had a relationship with Zani since they started as 3 or 4 year olds. So it's not as if they're transitioning to a brand new teacher. They know,
So their assistant is already elementary trained or is going to be
elementary trained.
Okay. Yep. That is what a great model that is. And then you're going to move into as many as 6 or 8 classrooms. What if there's like a 500 people on your waiting list and they are like, please make more of these.
Well, one of the nice things about DC and the way chartering goes is that, we have this 5-year charter. Mm-hmm. And so when we get to 5 years, if we've been successful in getting all of these campuses started, I don't anticipate that we won't. I think it's a really popular, Wildflower is popular. And I think our support system and the way we're thinking about it is going to make sure that these teacher leads are successful. We could theoretically go back and say, we would like to see if there's space to do more classrooms, right? Or potentially We could ask the charter school board if we could expand our age range, and maybe we can try to do adolescent programs.
I
So
was
it
just
is.
talking with Katie Brown at NCNPS, and she said, I asked her what are the trends, and she said one of them was that like there's a bigger interest in adolescent programs now.
Imagine, I admit that that seems super appealing to me, right? DC is so lucky because we have the public, we have Capitol Hill Montessori, which is a public school that is fully Montessori and goes from pre-K three to eighth grade. So there's already an opportunity there for people to get adolescent Montessori. And then there's Sojourner Truth Montessori, which is a middle and high school. They just started their first ninth grade class. So they're just kind of growing into high school, which is amazing. And so, in DC, there are already two pathways, right, to adolescent Montessori. We just really need to pay attention to what people are asking for, but I do think that there's a possibility, strong possibility, that people will see it and recognize that that's a thing that they would like to either build if they're trained, or support if they're families who are thinking that they like to keep their children in Montessori.
Well, I have a question that I guess just is popping up to me that's sort of organic based upon what you're talking about. But I once was sort of helping very sort of minimally on the side some friends who started a wildflower school or attempted to start one. And it ended up being really challenging because they didn't have a U. There were two teachers who were teaching and they weren't necessarily wanting to do certain things that you have to do in that administrative level. But I also know that wildflower is non-hierarchical in nature. And so I'm imagining that how it's set up is that, they see you as like maybe not their boss who tells them what to do in the day-to-day life, but you're like a support system for them and making sure that they can be their best selves.
I think of us more. Wildflower broadly talks a lot about circles, right? And that you kind of have these circles of work, of practice. And so if you would think of DC Wildflower as a big circle, almost like a cell, there are little structures within that structure, So, our board has work that they do. And I've got to tell you also, just, tangentially, best working relationship I've ever had with a board or as a board member, right? It's just lovely, lovely, really committed group of people and a different way of being with us as a board that is so refreshing. Hard. I mean, we're unlearning, all of us are unlearning a lot of our hierarchical ways of being. But yeah, I think of us as being this little nucleus that they can rely on. So I give a lot of advice. I do a lot of coaching, lots of, Rochelle, what do you think about, this situation? And I try, my role really is to try not to make a decision for them, but to provide a foil, or provide a listening ear, or provide more information, or context that I might have based on my experience so that they can make the best possible decision, right? And I'm certainly, by no means am I the only advice giver, right? So I have a really well experienced student support partner who brings special education, ELL experience as a teacher, but then also as an administrator and, and a school leader. So she's got this really deep
Adapt,
understanding, right? And understanding experience around special education and children with special needs. And then our operations person similarly brings a lot of experience doing everything from on-campus operations across multiple campuses, which is where we'll be, to really digging in and understanding the enrollment process. So, I mean, I have to say I got super, super lucky, but the three of us really just provide some depth, some depth and some grounding for the teacher leaders, right? And it sounds like in that example, they didn't have, they didn't necessarily
There wasn't a point
have
person
it globally, right? I will say I go to the Wildflower Foundation. So they, have a lot of experience, and there are other charters in the country. So there are wildflower charters in Minnesota, in New York, and growing in Colorado. So they, the four of us spend time as well talking about how to balance the needs of a charter, which are really different from an independent school, right? A charter and a public school, and the kinds of decisions that have to get made, the places where things do maybe have to be consistent in a way that they might not have to be if it was just six independent schools, right?
Because
they could do, they could kind of do whatever they wanted without affecting each other. But because we're all part of a charter,
there's certain accountability measures that you have
to. We have to balance. There are some places where decision making is not entirely free, right? But usually,
they know that coming into it. I mean, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because you choose to become part of the charter, and you choose to come to the charter because you get this per pupil funding, right?
Yeah.
So you have this kind of guaranteed funding. If you meet your enrollment targets, you get funding to support your staff, and you get funding to support your facility, which independent schools don't necessarily get, right?
Yes, absolutely. So it seems like such an interesting thing. And it makes me think that a lot of teachers would find this model appealing. Do you see it growing, like in, you know, people really getting interested in this, particularly like a lot of teachers are struggling with like the accountability measures that are getting so intense in like public education, and they're feeling like, I can't practice Montessori the way I know it goes back.
I do think so. One thing that I think is interesting that both Ebony and Zani have said separately is that they now have gained some appreciation for the decisions that were made that they remember kind of, for lack of a better word, you know, like railing against when they were teachers, right?
Yes.
They're decisions that administrators make that do not make sense to teachers, right? Because they don't have necessarily the context. And so now I do appreciate that Ebony and Zani every once in a while will be like, okay, so now I understand how that decision got made, right? I have now much more perspective. I may still not agree with it, and we may still not make the same decision, but now at least I can see what, you know, I can see the trail now of how that decision was made. So I do think this is a great opportunity for people who want to do more than kind of just show up at work, right? You absolutely can't just show up. You really do have to be willing to think deeply and be really clear about what is, to have a clear and more clear vision of what you want your learning environment to be like, what you want your relationship with families to be like. And so if you're that person who's already thinking about teaching in that way, like kind of meta, you know, you're already very meta about your teaching and your practice, and you can find someone that you like to work with, and you think that you have enough of your ideas in common and aligned, it's an awesome opportunity. It's a really great opportunity, regardless of whether you're able to do, you know, public or not. I think even if you're able to do an independent Wildflower, it's such a lovely opportunity to just have a tiny little personal Montessori program, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you've kind of have answered this along the way, but maybe there's more that you want to add to it, which was, you know, what makes the work you do unique while also being aligned to Montessori principles and practices?
One of the things that I really appreciate about the Wildflower Foundation is that when they talk about how we are together, they situate adult relationships also in this idea of Montessori, right? How we give children freedom to make choices. We give them often, you know, the context for the decision that they're going to make. We give them the resources that they need. We don't expect them to make everything up. You know, we give that first lesson that sparks, you know, that sparks the interest, and we are responsive to their needs. That's very much the way we are trying to be with each other as adults, right? We spend a lot of time building community and having kind of the adult equivalent of morning circle, you know, or, you know, regular check-ins with each other so that we make sure that we know each other very deeply. It's a tiny team. We're only five, right? Uh-huh. And so we know each other very deeply. We spend a lot of time getting to know each other, just as you would in your classroom. And we respect each other's differences and each other's capabilities. There's never a question of someone not being capable of something, right? It's just a question of how much support are you, going to need or want to get this done? And that's very often how the question is asked, right? You have this task to do. How much, do you need help from me? If you do, what can I do? So that people have the opportunity to try to do something independently if they would like, or tap in, call on a friend and get some support if they need it. And I love that. That's, it's such a great way to work. I really appreciate as well being an advice giver and not a decider a lot of the time, right? It's nice to have be able to have an opinion without, not even an opinion. It's nice to provide information and know that it will just get used as that, right? That I'm not saying that I'm right. Just giving my experience, sharing what I know. And if I really feel strongly that a decision is going to be damaging, I have the right to say that, and push on it. But most of the time, it's really just a matter of having that opportunity to give the advice, right? Or to just to kind of throw, I don't want to say throw my hands up, but like just take a step back and wait to be asked. That's really hard. Just super hard to wait to be asked for advice. Yeah, so I think that those are some ways that the way that I work with these teacher leaders and with the rest of my team is different than you might hear from a more traditional school leader or charter leader, right? And so I am in the position of trying to balance that with external expectation that I'm going to just make a decision, or that if anything that got decided, someone has a question about it that they would ask me. And sometimes I'm like, well, it wasn't my decision. I can go ask, I can go find out more if you'd like, but.
Yeah, and some of what you're talking about is related to working in a small school, because I worked in a small school with just two classrooms for several years, and it is so different. And you came from a large school. You were at a large public school, and somebody once told me, when you're starting something new, there is a lot of uncertainty, but there's also a lot of freedom. In fact, a man once said to me, "From chaos comes order, but not without the cost of freedom." And so, when you have a more bigger, larger environment, then you need the policies and the procedures and all of that needs to be in place. But if you're small, you can kind of be a little more flexible. But at the same time, when without telling a long story, I found myself maybe being a little too flexible in terms of like, oh, we maybe do need to make sure we're having regular meetings and things like that instead of casually seeing each other because it's a small, two room place, So there's that need to be flexible and also the need to kind of have those structures in place so that
And
everybody
support
kind
it.
of knows
Yeah,
what
and
to
support it.
expect.
Yeah. I think what I think I would call it is, making sure that you have structures and procedures in place that support that flexibility, right? So make sure that you have a regular weekly meeting so that you're talking to each other. Because then, if something comes up, you're not going a month before you're talking about it, right? Because there's always this place where you can bring the concern and share or get on the agenda. Like I don't design the agenda. We group design the agenda so that if something's coming up for somebody else, we prioritize together how we'll work through our weekly agenda. And some of the stuff can be shared, right? We don't necessarily have to talk about it in meeting. And we trust each other to read, right? If we're just sharing, then we have a small enough community that we can trust that we are all like reading those updates and know what's going on.
It sounds like everybody feels a pretty strong sense of ownership around
Yeah,
things.
I would say so. And accountability to each other. I think there's a really strong sense of accountability to each other, right? That we can have this freedom and this ability to make our own decisions and kind of make our own path where within our scopes of work, because we trust each other to do the same, right? And to be thinking about where, my scope of work impacts your scope of work. And so I should talk to you about it because I might be impacting your day or, what you're thinking you're going to do. So we've been, it's, I mean, I will say it has not been without any, without any error. And this
Some
summer when,
little bumps along the way.
oh, sure. Like this summer, we weren't meeting as regularly. And we really got to early August, and all of us were just like, oh my goodness, like we need to get back to that weekly meeting because too much was, we were just going so fast that, as we were trying to get open, that you know, that the decisions were getting made without discussions being really explicit. And so we knew that that weekly meeting had to happen, that like we experienced what it was like without it.
Oh, goodness. I can see. Sometimes it's just like you don't realize you need something until you're like in the middle of something. You're like, oh, we need this thing. So what would you say are some of the joys and challenges of implementing Montessori in a public school setting? And I know you've been in different kinds of public school settings. Yep. So yep. You might have insight on that.
I really appreciate the diversity of our student body. Interestingly, all of our children are Black and Brown, but they have very diverse backgrounds, right? So even within that kind of visual similarity, there is diversity of economic background, there's diversity of ethnicity, there's diversity of language and familiarity with Montessori, just so many different, you know, children with different abilities. It's just a really diverse group of students and families. And I think that that is a thing that is maybe more likely to be fostered by a lottery system in a diverse city, right?
Yeah.
So that I think is a really lovely byproduct of our community. I am really surprised at how, I will say that we faced, and I say we, because I was arguing with them about this, but supporting them rather, we decided to start really small, right? We decided to start with 18 students. And I will tell you, as you can imagine, in the public sector, lots of pushback on a size that small. Like, oh my gosh, you guys are never going to be able to support it. Are you sure? And they, and Ebony and Zani were really clear that the reason they wanted to do that was so that they could pour into those 18 children, right? And when we get new children next year,
they would be strong leaders, right?
So strong, right? And when I tell you that they were right, it feels so much better than places where we have started with swaths of children who don't have any experience, right? And none of these children have experience with Montessori. So it's, or actually maybe one or two do, but they're new to school. They're 3 and 4 year olds. So it's not like we're, you know, we're starting with kids who have a lot of Montessori.
Yeah.
It's just that the small number allows this very personal attention to their individual needs and their family's individual needs, which is not necessarily a public sector thing, but I do, that is something I learned in starting up other campuses, right? So, you know, I learned that watching.
Well, it's just more likely that in a public setting, there's like, you know, a huge number of people who want to come in at once, whereas it would, it is more of a slow build in the independent sector. And, you know, so, you know, I've been there before where it's like, okay, we want to put a couple more in. And you're like, ah, no, like this room is packed. You know, we can't fit another child in here. And it's often not about the size of the group of children as it is the space that they occupy. Like you cannot squeeze 30 children. In 30 children into like a 700 square foot space is just not ideal.
No. Yeah. And I think it's, these are also lessons that Ebony, Zani and I learned watching it be done differently in other places, right? Mm-hmm. Watching how hard it is. But, you know, so that's kind of the flip side of it, is it's great to be able to start small and slow. And it is also wonderful to be able to have such a diverse group of students and to know that parents are really, so far, and I think we'll continue to be really grateful and recognize this opportunity that their children are getting. So that's a nice thing as well about the public sector, right? That the folks who end up with you and who begin to learn about Montessori really are so happy for the fact that maybe they stumbled into it, or maybe they knew, but they recognize what they are getting and are really happy about it, right?
And they're committed, right? And they're committed families.
Great way to learn. Yeah.
So what does a successful Montessori school look like to you? And what do you think public Montessori schools need in order to experience success? That's a big question, I know. But I thought you're the right person to try on.
Very nice. Nice of you. So one of the things that I know is true is that if we want Montessori to be appealing to more families, BIPOC families, you know, diverse families, We need to have educators who are also diverse, and we need to figure out how to do Montessori in the spirit of the methodology in a way that keeps pace with our modern time, right? That is somewhere, I'm sure I have a pedagogical advisor being frustrated with me, but I don't mean walking away from Montessori. What I mean is thinking about the intent of a work or the intent of a lesson or the reason behind the thing that we're doing, and whether or not there might be a way to get at that thing in a way that resonates more directly with the children that we have in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
Simple example in primary is shoe polishing, right? Shoe polishing is great. And there may be still families who polish shoes.
I don't know any who do, but...
However, if what you're wanting, if the intention of that work is to build hand strength and to be able to follow multi-step directions and to be taking care of shoes, hey, got a lot of sneakerheads out there. Maybe the kids should learn to clean a sneaker because they're going to be, they're like more likely to be wearing a sneaker that needs to be cleaned than wearing a shoe that needs to be polished, right? And so could you substitute that kind of more modern work for what might be a little bit more old-fashioned work or unfamiliar work to the children and still be meeting the same aim, right? So just a super simple example. And so I think it's exciting that when I talk to public Montessorians, I hear more and more that they're thinking in that way, right? How do I keep the spirit of this? Mm-hmm. How do I keep the intention of this and be aware that quite possibly the children that are in front of me are not the same as the ones that some of these lessons were written for, right?
It kind of reminds me of something that people who know me, I know I say this probably way too much, but it's sort of like that we agree or we're in alignment with the what. Like they need to like develop their fine motor coordination, mm-hmm. their concentration. But like there's the how. Like how can we, like there are many different hows to that same what. Yeah.
And then the what and the why, right? It's mm-hmm. those things.
Oh, and the why, the how, yes.
You know, the how doesn't have to be so prescribed, I think. So I think in the public sector, that's one place where that is happening by necessity. And I think it can happen more as we continue to get more and more diverse teachers from, teachers from different backgrounds, teachers from different experience, and similarly, families and children with different experience. So I do see that happening. And I see some really interesting work happening at all levels too, right? I recently was talking with a toddler teacher who's having that same thinking, right? How do I make these pieces of work that these lessons and materials that I have been given more relevant for these toddlers that are in front of me because they don't know what this thing is that they're being asked to work with. They've never seen one before.
Yeah.
But I bet there's something else I could put, I could substitute for it that they would recognize. And
yeah, it's not very practical life-ish if it's not very practical in their life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah. If it's something that they've never seen and probably won't see except in your classroom, is that practical life for them? But
right.
So yeah, I think I'm here for all of those conversations. I think that that's really important. And we at Wildflower, and I think my team in particular, really believe that Montessori can be liberatory if it is done well, mm-hmm. because it frees your mind, right? It can create this amazing relationship with learning, right? This thirst for learning and questioning in the best way, right? And wanting to know more and knowing how to know more, right? Knowing how to find out more about things and knowing how to interact with others. That's one of the things that I appreciate the most about my Montessori kid who's grown up now. And I know you, you also have,
Montessori. Yes, they know how to be in the regular world in a lot easier way.
They do. They're familiar with kind of looking up around at what's happening and finding their way, right? And finding a way to bring others with them often.
And I often also think, like, particularly if they were in Montessori Elementary, they learn how to negotiate and
Yes.
collaborate and
Yes.
discuss and debate
Yeah.
and do those, they practice those things in that, like, little petri
Yeah,
dish
it's
called
just who they are at the
the
moment.
elementary classroom. Exactly. Well,
Petri dish is exactly right.
another quick question to ask you that's related to something you were talked about earlier that is just, do you have any ideas or strategies on how we can bring or make it more appealing for Black and Brown people to come into Montessori and become teachers and be these role models for children and get excited about Montessori and even know about it
Yeah.
and all that, all the things, all the things.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big things is that we need to do a better job is that those of us who are already doing it need to do a better job of getting people into our classrooms, right? Giving people opportunities to see it and calling their attention to what they're seeing, the good things, right? I think sometimes people walk into a Montessori classroom and if they're have a more kind of traditional orientation or like, this is chaos. This is crazy. What's going on in here? But if you let them sit and you give them some things to look for, they'll start to see how amazing it is, right? They will start to see, oh, like those kids are just, they just worked that whole problem out and I didn't have, and nobody intervened, right? They see it's not, you know, it's not perfect almost ever. But if you give yourself, if we give people opportunities to see, to see the beauty of being with children in that way, I think that they are often drawn to it because it is a really different, you know, it feels, I think it feels better, right? It's a great feeling when you're a Montessori teacher being with children, right? That guiding rather than directing is just lovely. Like you are people together and not, you know, and not kind of, I used to joke. My daughter's teacher used to say she was queen of all she surveyed. And she was really, you know who she was. It was a joke, but it also is the way we sometimes can be in our classrooms, right? But I think what she meant more was like, this is a microcosm and a community. And in this community, I am a benevolent leader, right? But I am, in fact, ultimately kind of responsible for what happens in this classroom, right? And so there needs to be a healthy amount of that, but it is a different, it just feels different when the children are co-creators with you of that space, right? I think a lot of folks that I really respect have been talking in the last year or two so much about co-creating the space with the children and how important that is. And I think as well as adults, right? Co-creating your classroom with your assistant, if you have an assistant, with your, you know, with specialists who are coming in, with special educators who are coming in, and really thinking about Montessori as a group, as a place where a group of adults are creating this environment where children can be successful, right? And so regardless, I think we Black and Brown people have often been in the role, in the roles that are a little bit less respected in the in Montessori classrooms. And I think that that has been hard because you don't necessarily want to be a teacher if you've had a negative experience of, you know, of having a teacher not be respectful, right? Like, or you may not, yeah, you may not want to be in charge of that if you feel like it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't been positive for you. So I think there's some of that acknowledgement that we have a little, we have some hierarchy things that we need to work out.
I think that if we're not careful, that the Montessori classroom can be more hierarchical than a traditional classroom.
Yeah.
And also, because of the very idea of choice in the classroom, I actually just recently wrote a blog post about this, that the elementary environment in particular can, like, augment bias if everybody's choosing who they're working with all the time, and the teacher
Yes.
isn't
Supporting.
mindful of mixing things up and starting to just have people work with their friends and giving lessons with them because it's easier than having, like, protests, you know. So
Yeah.
it's
You really
interesting.
do have to be very aware of those things. And then I think the last bit of it is access, right? So we need to figure out ways to make training more accessible. We need to make it, I don't know whether money's for sure is one of the questions, but even just
time.
what you remember, right? It's time and it's cognitive load, right? Training is not easy. It
very
is a, it's,
hard.
You and I both trained in, you know, probably about the same time. And it is, that's not the way I ever had to learn, you know?
No.
And so even if you have come from school and you were successful at school, it is still an unusual way to learn for adults. And so, you know, acknowledging that and putting some supports around it, figuring out ways to make it more accessible will really help so that people don't end up feeling like they're not being successful and not wanting to say anything, right? And or not even enter because they have heard that it's hard, right? And so they put themselves at risk.
So I mean, just, you know, creating access and support. I think the support piece and, you know,
and
with
coaching,
training centers.
You know, so I mean, I know you've done a lot of this, right? Like making sure that there are really good resources for new teachers so that you have, you know, you have coaching, you have whatever is the thing that's going to help you the best, right? Like, are you a person who can read, or do you need to watch videos, or do you need, you know, a blog, or, you know, do you just need a live person you can ask questions to? The more we build up those different modalities of getting support for new teachers, the better, right?
Yeah.
The more we'll keep people in the field.
Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of trainings now have sort of pre-recorded videos that you can watch over and over again. And I'm just like, oh, I wish I had that when I was writing my albums, particularly when I was sick, you know, because those days where I'm like, oh my gosh. And
I can't even think, much less, take down this lesson on the algebraic.
Yes, I was really sick during the decimal board presentation for like 3 days I missed. And I remember somebody saying, actually, I think it was the trainer said, oh, when you miss a day, it's just you never quite get that lesson down, you know, and that's stuck with me. And I think that's a limiting belief. And I won't subscribe to it. But I also at the same time, see like how hard it is when you do miss even a little piece of that. So this day after post COVID, when everyone's busy, people don't have money, they don't have time, getting people into this work is just so crucial. And I just would hope, I hope there's like a big think tank that just sort of comes together and solves this problem of not having enough
teachers
in general.
All the training people are, I know what gives me hope is that I know that all the various training organizations are feeling this drive to try to
urgency,
address it, right? This sense of urgency and this recognition that, you know, and also we have a generation of teachers and trainers that are retiring, right? And and so we need young folks to step into the fray, or if not young, new, you know.
Yeah, and maybe do a little reinventing of some things while keeping, you know, a high fidelity program in place. Well, gosh, we probably could keep talking, and this is probably one of my longer podcasts I've done, but it's so fun talking to you about this stuff.
It is.
Thank you so much for coming to this podcast and for sharing your expertise. Again, this is Rochelle Comboco from DC Public Wildflower Charter School. That's a mouthful, I guess.
Yeah.
And they're doing really good things there. Can they look you guys up on a website and learn about?
They can. It's DC Wildflower PCS Public Charter School.org.
Okay. Yeah. And then so people can kind of keep in touch with what you're doing.
Absolutely. And yes. And one day when I'm a grown up executive director.
Yeah. And maybe seek you out for like, hey, I want to come teach it. I want to open a wildflower school, and maybe you can point them in the right direction.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. And it was great having you today.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Trillium Montessori Talks. If you enjoyed this podcast, you will love the practical and actionable classroom management advice in the Montessori Principles to Practice webinar libraries. Head to trilliummontessori.org/podcast for details and to learn about all the ways we can help you optimize your Montessori work. We'll be back soon with more Montessori inspiration. In the meantime, please help other Montessori guides find this podcast by leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast listening platform. Thank you for being a part of the Trillium community.